Hi, everybody. I'm Dee Dee West. I just want to give a little heads up before we start today's episode. Today's episode is going to feature a special guest, a child actor who appeared on season 7 through 10 of Nickelodeon's All That. We didn't anticipate recording this amidst the release of the new documentary Quiet on Set, and our conversation took place before either of us had actually seen it. Our guest opted out of participating in the documentary, so we won't be delving into discussions about abuse within Nickelodeon on today's show. It's important to note that each actor on the show had their own unique experiences, and any insights shared by our guests today aren't intended to undermine anyone else's journey. Hello, everybody. I'm Dee Dee West, and this is Broken Limelight. Happy St. Patty's Day. It's probably like a whole week and a half, maybe even 2 weeks after St. Patrick's Day by the time you're listening to this. But nonetheless, I wish you had a happy one. Today, we're going to talk about Woodstock 99. But before we get into today's episode, I want to welcome our very special guest, who happens to be a redheaded Irish queen. You might remember her from the Nickelodeon show All That, or her many other roles on various sitcoms. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm welcome to Lisa fucking Foyles.
Yay! Audience goes wild. Applause. Pyrotechnics. That was the nicest intro ever. Thank you so much.
You're Lisa fucking Foyles.
Ah, it's me! Ah!
As you may remember from shows like Even Steven, that's Malcolm right. In the Middle, and of course, just All right. That. And the
list
crowd goes off. Wild.
List that IMDb list. All. Let's go down the line.
Lisa Foyles is here with us today, guys. I know this is kind of weird. It kind of feels like I'm stalking you, but I promise it's all research.
No, I totally get it. You're a professional. You're a professional. And I love you and you're great. And this is going to be so much fun. And, you know, this is just for us, right? We're not recording any of this. It's just you and me chatting. That's all it is. We're totally talking.
I'm just going to tell you all about Woodstock 99, Lisa Foyles.
Yeah, please do. I've never heard anything about it. So, sounds like a nice time. Sounds like a really, really relaxing, fun getaway. So
totally.
Peace and love. Yep. Mm-hmm. Harmony.
So have you seen any of the documentaries about Woodstock 99?
Oh, girl. Oh, girl, yes. I've seen it. I've probably seen it 3 times, honestly. In fact, it's so wild. I don't know how many documentaries there are on Woodstock 99, but specifically the train wreck one on Netflix. My very good friend JD was just in town for St. Patty's Day. And I mentioned that I was going to be talking about Woodstock 99. And he's like, what is that? What happened? And I'm like, oh, you don't know? Okay. Sit, come gather around, children. Sit down and hear a tale most dire of the incredibly insane things that happened at good old Woodstock 99. So then we watched it again. So I just recently saw it again and got to relive all the magical moments. These magic moments.
So it all started with the original Woodstock in 1969. 500,000 people attended. And it's now known as it's got this legendary, iconic status. So that original Woodstock Festival of 1969 was conceived of by 4 men from New York City named Michael Lang, Artie Cornfield, John Roberts, and Joel Rosenman. So Lang and Cornfield, they both had experience in the music industry, and Michael Lang had headed other music festivals like the Miami Pop Festival in 1968, and Cornfield had served as the youngest vice president at Capitol Records. The other two guys, Roberts and Rosenman, they were just like wealthy New York entrepreneurs who were interested in making a new investment. So the 4 of them got together and they had this big idea to create a recording studio in Woodstock, New York, under the name Woodstock Ventures. So all that didn't end up working out, but the whole idea of the music festival was that they were raising money for this music festival. Or I'm sorry, they were raising money for this recording studio. So that original music festival featured acts like Joan Baez, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, Santana, Joe Cocker, etc., etc. So many people showed up, like there was so much traffic that people literally on their way to the festival would just like get stuck in traffic and they would just leave their cars there. They'd just park their cars, get out, and walk to the festival. A few things that come to mind about Woodstock 69 were like lots of topless women. It was the 60s. It was the days of sexual liberation and the fight for feminism. So like in this event, what was cool was a lot of people became like a community and they ended up like trading things like drugs for food or like, hey, I'll give you my magic mushrooms for your tie-dye t-shirt. And like people ended up having to like, they have to like camp out there and live there for like the weekend. So there was a lot of drug use. There was a lot of sex. I believe it rained at some point and lots of people played in the mud. It was all very free-spirited. So in 1994, one of the original founders, Michael Lang, wanted to bring it back for the 25th anniversary. Michael Lang's idea was to function as a bridge from music from the 60s and what was contemporary in the 90s. So he replicated a lineup that was close to 69's with like Santana and the Cranberries. And this was intended to be like one last hurrah for baby boomers and maybe their kids too. This event had a lot of its own problems. Like,
yeah.
Most notably, the gate was broken down and a lot of people broke into it. Like, it was something like 190,000 people broke into the event for free.
Yeah, they lost a ton of money on Woodstock 94, obviously, because of, you know, that was a really shining moment for like a fence company to step up, right? To be like, yo, what's up, Woodstock 99? We're Bob's Fences and we saw what happened in 94. That won't happen on our watch. Bob's Fences to the rescue. But instead, they put up wooden fences, right? They put up a bunch of wood around the tarmac because let's be honest, they picked tarmac, like the most like war zone looking place, like a place where like helicopters and like military activity would happen. Like in this place, there's like airplane hangars and tarmac and not very much grass and no shade. And the promoters of the Woodstock 99 crew was like, this is it. This is the perfect spot. Let's do this. Kids love standing on concrete for days at a time. They'll love it.
Yeah, the scenery was very different at this Woodstock than the original Woodstock. Because of the amount of people anticipated at these events, they required a location with a lot of open space and like where there wouldn't be any neighbors or anybody complaining about the sound and things like that. The original Woodstock 69 actually had a lot of trouble finding a location, but ultimately they found a guy with a farm who like he was willing to let them use it for like $50,000 or something. So when you think of Woodstock 69, you think of people sitting like on lush green grass hills, like possibly under a tree. Well, Woodstock 99 took place at Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York. So like the entire place was just concrete and tarmac. Like there was no greenery in sight. And like, isn't that so ironic? Like Woodstock 99 was supposed to be the 30th anniversary celebration of Woodstock 69, which was a celebration of love and peace and music amid the Vietnam War. A lot of the musicians there were sending anti-war messages, and these guys said, you know where we can replicate that? A U.S. military base.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, logistically, it made a lot of sense because this was a place that already had things like running water and electricity and things like that. And, like, a military base is huge. It's already got its own, like, housing and facilities, and most importantly, it's already gated, so people couldn't get in without tickets like in 1994. Unfortunately, the temperatures reached 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Because the entire base was tarmac, the scorching heat was just unbearable. And there was no trees, which meant there was like very little shade. So people were literally like climbing underneath trucks and stuff like to pass out and get some shade. Even more difficult, the two main stages were like a mile and a half away from each other. So people quickly became really hot and dehydrated and sunburnt from head to toe on day one. The festival was attended by almost 400,000 people. People spent their graduation money on it because, like, tickets started at $150, which was a lot back then. But it was a lot of bands, so people tried to justify, like, okay, that would be, like, $50 per day to see, like, all these bands that I really like. So in order to prevent party crashers, like in 1994, the promoters insisted on building a 12-foot fence that was made of steel and plywood to keep people out. They called it the Peace Wall, which, again, is ironic, isn't it? And the plywood was painted in all these colorful images, like in like psychedelic colors, to represent the peace and love of the original Woodstock Festival. These plywood walls would eventually be torn down into pieces, Some people would use them like surfboards while crowd surfing, and ultimately, many of the pieces were set on fire. It's early in the episode, so that probably sounds like a lot, but this festival is going to become like an apocalypse now.
They'll love it. Let's charge them $200 to stand on concrete for days at a time and not give them water. But yeah, so then they, so they lost so much money. Woodstock 94, they're like, we need to try this again, but we want to make money this time. So they're like, okay, let's put on this event, but let's cut every corner possible. Let's cut those corners because we love peace and love and we love the people. We love the music, but also we like money a little bit more. Because we're mostly a bunch of old white guys who are so out of touch with everything.
Producers, especially Michael Lang, wanted people to enjoy the hippie vibe, but they also wanted a huge profit. Ultimately, that means it's not very hippie now, is it, Michael? The event was sponsored by many businesses, with MTV benefiting the most by hosting the event and selling it on pay-per-view. A personal pizza ended up costing $12. A burrito, which was probably like a little frozen one, was costing $10. A bottle of water started off costing $4 at the beginning of the event, which is already ridiculous today, but in 1999 was just, like, unfathomable. But by the third day, that price of a water bottle had raised to $10.
Yeah, which inflation, I mean, I'm sure now it's like, that would be like $25, you know?
Everyone was hot and dehydrated, and the water was expensive.
I think it's true, they weren't allowed to bring stuff in, right?
They didn't allow any outside food or drinks, not even water. So people had no choice but to buy water inside of the music festival.
Dude, you can bring stuff into Disneyland. you can bring sandwiches.
The event had a couple of water fountains, but not nearly enough. So the lines were endless. Eventually, people got tired of waiting and somebody broke one of the water pipes. So water just kind of started spraying everywhere, and that turned into puddles, and that turned into like a bunch of mud all over the place. So people started bathing in the water and like playing in the mud, probably like reminiscent of the Woodstock 69 concert.
Except it wasn't mud.
But nonetheless, there was one less like drinkable water source. So this added to the list of essential needs of the concert goers that the concert staff was not providing. The entire atmosphere had set up the attendees to not only be angry, but pretty much be fighting to survive. And we haven't even started to talk about the actual music or the bands yet. The lineup was all over the place. Included were most notably Limp Bizkit, Korn, Rage Against the Machine. There was also Rusted Roots, Fatboy Slim, Jamiroquai, Moby, DMX, Los Lobos. So the first official day of the festival was Friday, July 23rd, 1999. Hundreds of people were anxiously waiting for an epic opening show. The festival lacked sufficient security. They called the security guards the Peace Patrol, and these were really just young, college-age kids with no experience. Like they said in the documentaries, these were just kids who they were told, like, I'll give you $50 and all you have to do is sign this piece of paper and you can work at this festival. Unfortunately, they were not paid well, and they were not offered water, and they were given the impossible task of wrangling almost 500,000 people. So most of these people eventually just dropped their posts and joined the crowd. Many of them sold their yellow shirts. Like, people thought it would get them to backstage areas, so, like, they would use that to their advantage and, like, sell their shirts, be like, oh, this can get you access to anywhere you want. It also gave people access to, like, body search other people. And, like, grope women, which was a big problem. The opening act on the main stage was James Brown.
Okay, so, James Brown, right? This was the start of all of it, right? Was James Brown. At the very beginning, they start Woodstock 99, and they have, like, no money already. They're, like, in debt. They have no money. The whole point of this event was to try to make money, and they're already out of it. So I think James Brown on day one was, like, one of the first artists, right? And he was like, I'm not going on stage until you pay me my money up front. And they're like, well, that's not going to happen. And he's like, well, I guess I'm not going on stage then. But they said, oh, really? Oh, really? Okay, you go peek at the audience real quick.
Yeah, John's like, oh, okay, I'll get you your money. But first, I want you to hear something. And then he just starts the track. And he's already, like, in front of everybody. So he has no choice but to start performing.
That was, like, the first time, especially in the documentary, where they show the sea of people. Like, it, like they said a couple times, it was like one big organism, like, that just crammed in there like sardines, went for miles, so insane. So, I mean, I can see how James Brown would be like, okay, maybe we'll play. Maybe this might be the greatest show of our lives. So maybe we should definitely play this. And that I think was like the one moment where it seemed like maybe things were going to be fine.
Some of the other bands that performed on the main stage that day were Korn, Bush, The Offspring, Jamiroquai, Sheryl Crow, and DMX. By the end of day one, overcrowding logistical issues were evident. Attendees were struggling to access their basic needs, and the crowd was becoming increasingly hostile. The Peace Patrol was becoming smaller and smaller, and those that remained, they maybe didn't let people bring in water bottles, but they didn't give a fuck if anybody brought in drugs or booze, so it was pretty much chaotic from the beginning. Men and women both began taking their shirts off, which is kind of customary to the hippie culture, but it was also super hot outside. But men were constantly grabbing and groping women who were topless, and you can see that in the documentaries. And worse off, the woman in the documentaries probably didn't consent to being seen, being assaulted like that on television. Like, they probably didn't sign releases for that.
There's so much nudity. Like, girls are just taking their tops off left and right. Guys are grabbing their boobs. Like, it's so inappropriate. It's so inappropriate that, like, guys are putting their hands on their body. And it's also so appropriate that they're taking off their clothes. I mean, yes, girls should be, allowed to have just as much fun as guys, should feel comfortable. But also, everybody, stop getting naked. Like, this is still in public.
And even those who weren't topless were harassed incessantly. Groups of men would chant, "Show us your tits," and a lot of women said that men would surround them and, like, wouldn't let them go until they flashed them.
Everybody was getting molested left and right. It was horrible. It was so horrible. These clips that they're showing in the documentary of just girls getting groped left and right, and they're trying to crowd surf like the guys, like they're ha trying to have a good time, and they're just getting groped left and right. I'm like, can you imagine? So awful. Like, God, I would have been out of there in a second.
Trigger warning here. We're going to talk about sexual assault. Women who were crowd surfing were being groped and violated. There were reports of women having fingers and objects inserted into their vaginas while crowd surfing. One attendee said, "I saw someone push this girl into the mosh pit, a very skinny girl, maybe 90 to 100 pounds. Then a couple of guys started taking her clothes off. Not so much her top, but her bottom. They pulled her pants down, and they were violating her, and they were passing her back and forth. There were five guys that were raping this girl and having sex with her."
Oh, you saw it. Yes, you saw it in the documentary. This, like, these guys would, like, not let this poor girl go. They're like, hey, give her some space. And they don't. Just like that's, I mean, they started to turn into animals, like the whole thing.
Another attendee told the New York Times in 1999 that over the course of under 10 minutes, he saw five or six women get sexually assaulted. He said they were literally passing the woman from one guy to another. There was at least one guy assisting on almost everyone I saw holding the girl down. It was horrible. In response to all of these allegations, John Scher had this to say. "There were a lot of women who voluntarily had their tops off. Then you get into a mosh pit and you crowd surf. Could somebody have touched their breasts? Yes, I'm sure they did. What could I have done about it? I'm not sure I could have done anything." Aside from the attendees, there were also eight police officers who were accused of assaulting women. One officer was suspended without pay. So these women who were attacked weren't even in a safe place to report it. The promoters also showed photos of these topless girls on their website, again without their consent. It was a gallery of more than 150 partially or fully nude concert goers, and it said, "This is a real-time gallery. It is impossible for us to review photos or confirm their validity. We do not actively monitor the contents of this gallery and are not responsible for any photos posted." And then it advises anybody who is offended by specific photos to complain in my email. So you have to, like, they have to post the photo first, and then afterwards you have to complain about it and, like, hope that they'll take it down. And these photos had captions like "cute titties" and "nice pair" and "show your tits." Four rapes were officially reported. Of those four, two women were allegedly raped by groups of men in mosh pits while people around them cheered. In response to that, John Scher basically said that Woodstock was like a small city, so considering how many people were there really weren't that many rapes. New York State Police arrested two men in connection with Woodstock-related sex crimes, and police were investigating at least eight other sex crimes that allegedly took place during that three-day festival, including the two alleged gang rapes. One of the two arrests was a 26-year-old prison guard. He was accused of sexually assaulting a 15-year-old girl. There was a woman, her last name is really hard to pronounce, but her first name is Liz, and she attended the festival, but she left early because she saw that women were being assaulted, and she became really uncomfortable, and she decided to go home early. So, based on what she saw, she realized that there were a bunch of women who didn't tell their story or like didn't feel safe going to the police. So she decided, like a week after the festival, she started a website for people to anonymously report the assaults that occurred to them during the Woodstock Festival. Because, like, she was hearing whispers about rapes all over the place while she was there. And she also witnessed women in the mosh pit getting their clothing ripped off and groped. But again, there were only like eight women that came forward at the end of the day. So after she set up this anonymous website, she got dozens upon dozens of emails from women and young women, like girls as young as 14 years old, reporting assaults that occurred to them. Like these emails said things like, I had a bottle shoved up my vagina, or I had all my clothes ripped off in the mosh pit, or I was raped in a tent on Saturday night, and I was screaming and nobody did anything to stop it. She said, these women were scared, and many felt as if they were at least partially to blame because of what they were wearing or not wearing, or for being there in the first place. Which is really sad. Like, if these women were seen topless on TV and then they were to come forward about the assaults, they would be blamed for it. When bands like ICP and Korn came on, the crowd went absolutely wild, and the audience started to look like they were getting out of control. The mosh pits got crazy, and like, if you were to fall, you would get crushed and trampled on, and it would be really hard again for an ambulance or a gurney to reach you in the middle of that crowd, especially like as they're jumping up and down and like moshing. I heard an interesting perspective while researching that you don't often hear about. For the most part, the Woodstock 99 crowd was very different from the Woodstock 69 crowd. And I'm not trying to make generalizations here, but just like hear me out. In Woodstock 69, they were amidst a war that many people felt our country had no place to be involved in. And the hippie movement was a bunch of people insisting on not fighting, putting away our fists, and learning to love each other for our differences. And that's not to say people were not like that in 99, but they definitely were not in the majority. And America had a very sexist attitude in 99, very xenophobic as well. This was the era of Bill Clinton and his scandal with Monica Lewinsky. And there was like a specific area, there was a specific genre of movies and TV within like frat boy comedies, like sexist comedies like American Pie
Yeah,
and Fight Club.
Fight Club. Yeah, although I love Fight Club, so I can't dock Fight Club. But I mean, but yeah, it's like the Matrix, and like this very masculine, yeah, like.
So remember how I said that tickets cost an absurd $150 and some people used up all of their graduation money on it? So think about that. This concert was not super accessible. So what kind of happened was that a huge chunk of those concert goers were like rich white guys, frat boys, Menendez brother types, many of whom were there because they loved nu metal, which typically consisted of angry or nihilistic themes. And again, I'm not trying to say that all fans of nu metal are typically like angry and aggressive and just want to fight people, but I think if you were a fan of Korn, you would just go to a Korn concert. You weren't really trying to get into this kind of corporate greed concert. You know what I mean?
It started bad, and I do think that the kids attending were there for the music. They made that very clear. Like, you see all the MTV interviews. They had MTV there on the ground. They had microphones. Anybody who was taking video and interviewing kids, they made it very clear that they were sick of what MTV was doing. MTV had taken a turn. It used to be all about the music, and then it became, like Fight Club talks about, very commercialized and all about the money and very corporate. So these kids are very sick of seeing Backstreet Boys on MTV. They're sick of seeing Jessica Simpson. Like, they want real music. Overwhelmingly, people were there to see Korn. They were there to see Rage. Rage played, right? Yeah, I think it was Rage. Metallica. Yeah, and Limp Bizkit, you know, these heavier, more intense bands, like that's why they were there. So they already kind of came in with this mindset of like, fuck MTV, like fuck the man, like this is our event. So the kids kind of, you know, even from the beginning, they had an attitude, and that's fine. Like, go to your music festival, have your fun. That's what it's for.
Yeah, so those that went to see like Jewel and Dave Matthews Band and Rusted Root, they were greatly outnumbered by angry and aggressive white men. And I imagine because it was Woodstock that there were a lot of peaceful hippie types who were like really trying to make it like the original and like sadly were probably bullied and made fun of like by the majority. So you get all these angry frat boy types who are now sunburnt and dehydrated and getting charged up the asshole for water. And then Fred Durst becomes the actual hype man, telling the crowd to take all their negative energy that's building up and break stuff.
Oh my, yes, and my fave, yes, 100%. And my favorite part is that when the audience got out of control, because here we are, like late day one, day two, people are starting to get mad. This is not going well. My favorite part is how the crowd is getting unruly. They ask the rock stars to fix it. They're talking to Durst. They're talking to these bands. Yeah, like there, can you just go and do some crowd control because that's what you do, Limp Bizkit? And he's like, interesting. Okay, yeah, I'll get right on that. No, at any point, first of all, if anyone blames the bands for anything that happened at this show, they are so wrong. The bands went there to put on the best show that they could possibly put on, and they all did. And they all did. It's not the band's fault that the crowd went bonkers.
Fred Durst was the frontman for Limp Bizkit. He opened his set by saying to the audience, "Let me ask you a personal question. How many people ever woke up one morning and just decided it was one of those days and you're gonna break some shit?" He continues, "Time to reach down deep inside, take all that negative energy, and let that shit out of your fucking system." And the band starts playing their song Break Stuff, and the audience loses their mind. They're not just moshing now, they're beating each other up. People were trampled, bones were broken. The audience started climbing the sound tower and like ripping down pieces of plywood from the peace wall. And Fred Durst was pumping them up. He saw the crowd and he got pumped. It got to a point where they told him, "Dude, can you please try to calm them down?" He addressed the crowd and said, "Don't let anybody get hurt, but I don't think you should mellow out. That's what Alanis Morissette had you motherfuckers do. If someone falls, pick 'em up." At one point, it became clear that people had been trampled in the mosh pit and become seriously injured. So the medical team asked him to stop the set, and he and his band refused. Eventually, they cut off his sound. He later said in an interview, "I didn't see anybody getting hurt. You don't see that. When you're looking out on a sea of people and the stage is 20 feet in the air and you're performing and you're feeling your music, how do you expect us to see something bad going on?" But it's interesting because other bands did say that they saw stuff happening, and they actually like said they addressed the crowd. But I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't speak for them. I don't know. I don't know if maybe it got crazier and more obvious as time went on. But for example, Dexter Holland, the lead singer for The Offspring, he said this to the crowd. He said, "I've been noticing that there's a lot of girls coming over the top here crowd surfing, and they're getting really groped. You know what I mean? Now, I think just because a girl wants to go crowd surfing or whatever, that doesn't give a guy the right to molest them. You know what I'm saying? If you're a guy and you see a girl go overhead, give her a break. And if you're a girl and you see a guy go overhead, I want you to grab his fucking balls." Similarly, the Red Hot Chili Peppers bassist, Flea, he also addressed the crowd saying, "Hey, you know, just because a girl out there wants to feel free and take her shirt off doesn't mean a bunch of you have to go and grab her tits and stuff. Because they're her tits, they're not yours. You gotta leave those tits alone. Those tits are a girl's private property and they're a beautiful thing, so you've gotta respect them. Everyone should be kind to each other out here." Jonathan Davis from the band Korn, he had some words to say. He said, "We rocked that place that first night and everybody had fun. The second night, Limp Bizkit fucked it up for everybody. They really did. He instigated the whole damn thing. I was right there watching it." By the end of night one, the porta potties started overflowing. They didn't plan for that many people. So they weren't having them cleaned out regularly, and they were just overflowing and like leaking everywhere. And remember, one of the water pipes was broken. So like now there's like mud mixing in with like sewage water all over the place. And the people don't know that. So they're still playing in the mud and it's all over their bodies. They're like rolling around in it. And like then they're jumping into mosh pits. So like it's inevitable like for the mud to rub off on each other. And like the concert goers describe this unfathomable stench. Like it just stunk so bad because everybody's literally covered in shit. There were reports of people suffering from trench mouth, which is, you know, a gum infection that is known from like World War One or World War Two, one of those wars, because the sewage water had also leaked into the shower water and the drinking water. So like many people woke up on that last day to a very sore throat and cold sores all over their lips and like their tongue and their gums just all over the inside of their mouth.
I think even Sheryl Crow got it, right? They were like pelting like Sheryl Crow mm-hmm. and Jewel with like the shit mud. So gross.
Yeah.
That's what's so crazy is not to spoiler alert or anything, but so there were three deaths from this event. But none of them came from like the shit mud, from like drinking shit water. I'm like, what? Like that was the most surprising is that there was a death from heat stroke, obviously, like you said.
Yeah, so the guy who had cardiac arrest actually passed out during Metallica's set on day one. Metallica isn't mentioned a lot in the documentaries, but I read an account from a concert goer where she recalled that the lead singer, James Hetfield, he apparently tried to redirect the crowd's energy and try to get them to chill out and have fun. So this was just in the beginning. But during their set, a 24-year-old man named David DeRosa collapsed with a body temperature of 107 degrees. So he collapsed on day one, and 2 days later, on day three, he passed away.
There was no water, there was no shade. Nobody was getting the treatment that they needed. Kids were like passing out. So heat stroke, that makes sense. And then the two other, I think somebody got hit by a car, and then the other death was a heart attack, I think by like an older, I think somebody who worked there.
There was a 44-year-old man who died of cardiac arrest on the first day. And on the third day, a 28-year-old woman died after being hit by a van while walking along the road trying to leave the festival. So here's a trigger warning for car accidents. So she's walking along the road trying to leave, and I think she had car problems. So like she just decided to walk and get help. And there was a van full of 7 concert goers, and it's believed that the driver fell asleep behind the wheel. So the van rolled over several times and all 7 passengers rolled out of the vehicle. And this woman was hit by the van and did not survive. Yeah, so going back to the conditions of the place. Again, there was shit all over the place. And aside from that, the shower area that existed, it wasn't adequate. Like, here's what somebody said of the shower area. The shower area was a huge makeshift stall hastily constructed with plywood, one side for the guys, one side for the girls. The quote-unquote showers consisted of long pipes with holes in them every few feet, out of which would come a tired trickle of lukewarm water. Fully washing the shampoo and conditioner out of your hair was virtually impossible. There were no stalls, everyone showered together in one open area that was quickly flooded with a few inches of filthy water swirling around. Worse, with it being constructed of mere plywood, there was nothing to stop guys from peeking under to the girl's side or even climbing under, and quite a few did. I decided the first shower I took was my last when I looked down and saw a guy's leering face just 2 feet away. It was clear pretty quickly that this event was not about peace and love. Nobody gave a fuck about each other, and the event was clearly just trying to make a buck off of everyone. As another way to cut costs, the festival staff had outsourced their sanitation services, and these people also abandoned their jobs and joined the crowds. The entire place became a wasteland. People were throwing water bottles all over the place, among the audience and at performers.
Oh my gosh, they were throwing everything. Who was it who told everybody to start throwing stuff? And everybody, like, bottles and everything. I mean, that's like, and like rocks. Yeah, they were throwing like rocks. Yeah.
Yeah. A concert goer said, "A simple empty water bottle thrown into the air by someone in the crowd started an all-out war. After the first empty water bottle was thrown up into the crowd, then everyone was getting into it, chucking half-full water bottles, then full water bottles, then batteries, then whatever else they could get their hands on. All this was being thrown into mobs of people, knocking them in their heads, slamming them to the ground, and some even knocking a few unlucky souls unconscious. Carson Daly was reporting for TRL when he was pelted by a water bottle that was half filled with urine.
Oh, God. Gross. So gross.
One woman who attended the concert tried to encourage other people to help her pick up garbage, so she passed out garbage bags, and one person said to her, "I paid $150 to be here. You should clean it up." And she was just like, well, this is a different kind of Woodstock.
Yeah, what can you do? What can you do? Like, they're unprepared.
Day two of the concert was Saturday, July 24th, 1999. Among the acts that played on the second day was Kid Rock. He made a comment on the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, saying, "Monica Lewinsky is a fucking hoe, and Bill Clinton is a goddamn pimp." Then there was Wyclef Jean, Counting Crows, Dave Matthews, Alanis Morissette, and then acts like Limp Bizkit and Rage Against the Machine. Then on the other stage, there were acts like Ice Cube, Los Lobos, and Everclear. The band ICP decided to show their appreciation from the stage. They were like, "Hey, I know that the tickets were kind of expensive, and we got paid a lot of money to be here, so we decided to give you all your money back." And they, like, taped $100 bills to dodgeballs and started kicking them out to the audience. And the audience just started beating the shit out of each other, tearing each other apart, trying to get these $100 bills. And then once they were gone, they started kicking around dodgeballs with $500 bills. This is ICP again. We're talking about the Insane Clown Posse. So at one point, two of the members invited women onto the stage to take off their tops and then douse them with soda. Fatboy Slim played at the end of night two. He was in his little dressing area beforehand getting ready, and he could, like, hear that it was getting crazy out there, but nobody told him that there had been any damage or any violence or, like, any assault. So he goes on stage and he performs his first song, and, like, everybody's getting pumped. And then suddenly he sees this big platform in the audience, and he can't tell what it is. And it turns out to be a van.
There's all of a sudden this van, like it was a van or a truck or something, just starts, like, driving through the airport
with
hangar.
Apparently 20 or 30 people, like, hanging off of it.
Like, through the audience. And then when they open the back, obviously they find the horribleness.
So this van had been stolen and was literally just driving through the crowd. Super dangerous. Yeah. And then that's when, like, somebody goes up to Fatboy Slim and taps him on the shoulder. And they're like, "Dude, we got to stop. This van's got to go. Like, this is crazy dangerous." And then that's, like, when reality hits everybody. The stage manager gets to the van and he opens up the doors. And inside there's a guy with his eyes all glazed over, and he's holding a machete. And there's a girl in the van who is completely unconscious, and she's, like, 15 or 16.
Yeah, she's, like, super young.
And she's got her pants pulled down. Like, clearly she had just been assaulted. And as soon as the manager, like, turns to look at the guy with the machete, he's gone.
Oh, yeah, he's gone. Yeah, he'll never,
he just disappeared.
Never catch anybody.
Yeah.
It's so horrible. I mean, that right there, like, should have been the end of everything. Like, that should have been, like, the government get there.
So Fatboy Slim, he has no idea it's that serious. And all of a sudden, it's, like, real serious. And he gets scared. Like, the audience starts getting really hostile, and they told him that he had to fucking get the hell out of there, haul ass. Security guards ended up giving up on policing the campgrounds altogether.
Oh my gosh.
They had stopped sending cops and ambulances into that area because as soon as they entered, people started pelting them with rocks and mud. It was just like a no man's zone. There was no way to get help to this area.
Can you imagine? But nothing compares. Look, it's all bad. And first of all, I'm really into, like, omens, right? Like, good omens and bad omens. I read this amazing book called The Alchemist that James turned me on to. And they talk a lot about, it's like an old book, and they talk a lot about, like, good omens and bad omens, about, like, you know, taking cues in your life of where, what path you're supposed to take, and all that fun psychology. And before the show ever started, rewind to christen the show like a ship. They had a bottle of champagne, and they were gonna break the champagne and, like, yay, the event. the champagne would not break. Like they kept hitting it and hitting it and hitting it, and the bottle would not break. And I'm like, how many signs from the universe do you need that, like, don't do this, don't do this? I'm telling you right now, don't do this event. Okay, fine. You're gonna do it. Fine. Have fun. Like I was watching that, like that's such a bad omen. Like there, it's not breaking. But yeah, just fast forward. You're back, day three. The crowd is so mad. Everybody's in the worst conditions possible. Angry. They've been betrayed. They're already starting to tear the place down, right? Who is performing on early in day three?
Day three was Sunday, July 25th, 1999. This was the final day of the festival. Among the bands that played on this day are Rusted Root, Megadeth, Godsmack on one stage, and on the other main stage were bands like Creed, Elvis Costello, Willie Nelson, Brian Setzer Orchestra, and Jewel. And of course, at the end of the night, it'll be Red Hot Chili Peppers closing out the show. By this point, people are seeing Michael Lang and John Cher walking around and acting like everything's fine, while this place literally looks like a dystopian nightmare. Like an actual apocalyptic Lord of the Flies situation. People were tired and dehydrated and sunburnt and dirty and smelly and hungry and mad.
Oh, I totally believe. Like I said, I can't believe more people didn't die. Like it's shocking to me that more people didn't die. Especially when, yeah, was it during Chili Peppers or after the Chili Peppers when they're like, let's give them candles. I think that we should give them candles.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. So, one of the reasons that people were toughing it out by day three was because the entire weekend there were whispers that there was actually going to be some secret, super special final act after Red Hot Chili Peppers played. Everyone was sick and tired and had just had it with all of the shit, but they thought something incredible was going to happen and they probably wanted to get their money's worth at this point. And they probably didn't want to get like FOMO from missing out on this either. Because the Columbine shootings had just occurred a couple months earlier, which if you're not familiar with that, they were very famous school shooting that happened at a high school in Colorado in 1999. That had happened just a couple of months before this music festival. So there was this anti-gun group that had been handing out candles to concert goers for them to light during the Red Hot Chili Peppers performance of Under the Bridge as a way to stand against gun violence.
They're already mad, and you gave them fire. You gave them fire. What are you thinking?
They handed out 100,000 candles. And, eventually, concert goers started lighting shit on
Fire,
fire. They would light
as you do.
garbage, plywood, vehicles on fire. And the Red Hot Chili Peppers decided that this would be a good time to play tribute to Jimi Hendrix and play his song Fire. I did find, however, that Anthony Kiedis, the frontman for Red Hot Chili Peppers, he said that they played Fire because Jimi Hendrix's sister asked them to. Apparently, they didn't want Jimi Hendrix and like the spirit of Woodstock 69 to get lost in the midst of all this. And also, he said that nobody told them about the violence and the destruction that had been happening either, which I kind of believe, considering that the other bands didn't know either. I'm wondering if the producers intentionally kept it a secret to like not scare them out of doing the gig. They were like, close your eyes until you get on stage.
It's not his fault. It's not his fault. It's not his fault. They did an amazing job. It was a great show. It was gonna happen anyway. It was not, Chili Peppers did not tip anything over the edge that wasn't already tipping. Like it's, they did, they came, they did their job.
He also said that he didn't see any fires that looked out of control. According to him, they had performed at music festivals in the past where bonfires were started, and that's all that he thought was happening here. So he said to the crowd, "Holy shit, it's apocalypse now out there. Make way for the fire trucks."
No, then, yeah, then, so, you know what's funny is it really was kind of a beautiful moment when everybody did have the candles, like during the song, and it was like, wow, this is really pretty for 5 minutes. It was a nice idea.
After that song, the band went back to their hotel, and they found out the next morning that the news was vilifying them for playing that song. So after Red Hot Chili Peppers finished their set, the concert goers eagerly stuck around to see this super special big finale, and it ended up being just like a laser light show with footage of Jimi Hendrix performing at Woodstock 69. And this was just like the ultimate final straw for the audience. Riots erupted all over the place. This was just absolute anarchy. The place was up in flames, literally. they were lighting shit on fire and shouting, "Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me," which are lyrics from Rage Against the Machine, by the way.
Absolute chaos. However bad you think it is, it's worse. Like, it's so insane, this footage. Just fire everywhere. I mean, trucks are catching fire. They're exploding.
People were beating each other up, destroying ATMs and tearing down walls. Vendors and medical personnel were locking up their stalls and leaving.
Yes, people were fighting. There's fist fights. There's bonfires. They're bringing down these massive towers. They're then going after, yeah, like you said, the vendor tents. They're going after the staff. The staff's barricading doors because they're so terrified. They're ripping down the wooden signs. They're ripping. The people are taking anything they can. It's dangerous. It's scary. It's absolutely out of effing control.
Ultimately, John Scher and Michael Lang speak of the event like it went pretty well.
Yeah, totally.
They both agreed to appear in the documentaries that came up on Netflix and HBO Max.
Yeah.
And they have, like, no shame. Like,
yeah.
They legit don't think that they're to blame for anything bad that happened.
Yeah. The whole thing was an absolute nightmare. And even to the bitter end, the promoters were still trying to say it wasn't that bad. And yeah, they're just... They think it was a success. They're just lucky that iPhones didn't exist back then and people weren't just posting this.
Yeah, like, they mostly just blame the audience and Fred Durst.
I mean, look at Fyre Festival, you know, like, look at how social media was able to take that down and people were actually held responsible for some things that happened there, as opposed to in Woodstock 99, it's just like, all we have is just this old, like, MTV footage and camcorders, anybody who was taking, like, camcorder footage, that's it. Like, we have no idea the actual horrors that really did go on, because whatever we saw had to have been worse. It's only a portion, and it's just it's heartbreaking that that's how it all ended, and that, you know, it's that even happened. Like, that's the one thing I get when I was watching it with my friend JD. I was just like, this happened.
Oh god, Fyre Festival is just, that's another one that's on the list of future episodes to do. These are all good examples for how not to host a music festival. Just like the episode I did about Selena, where I talked about Astroworld a couple years ago, it's episode 22. Go listen to it. But I've talked in the past about how dangerous some of these music festivals have been historically due to carelessness and cutting costs and even to things that are like basic human needs. And there comes a point where, like, yeah, maybe the audience should be more on top of certain things. But at the same time, like, there's a level of trust that's placed in the people who are hosting the festival, you know?
It's so insane. Yeah, but I guess all we can do is just learn from our mistakes and put on better festivals and not ever do a Woodstock ever again. Can we not do another Woodstock? Maybe in like another 200 years.
Yeah. Michael Lang actually tried to do another Woodstock in 2019, but he passed away just a couple months after doing those documentaries on Netflix and HBO.
Yeah, he is not with us anymore, so he cannot create any more horrible festivals, but rest in peace. But yeah, so that's that happened.
All right, well, that's the story of Woodstock 99. Now let's get to know Lisa Foyles.
Let's do it.
Okay, Lisa Foyles, let's talk to you about your time on TV and getting into all that. Did you know that theme song was written by TLC?
Yes.
You probably didn't know that, didn't
performed
you?
Performed by TLC. You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
I did. You know, it's funny, in season 10, that was our big reunion season, right? So we brought so many original cast members back, and then I got to re-record the theme song with Lil Bow Wow. But it's not, he wasn't Lil anymore. He was just Bow Wow at that time. So it's me and Chelsea and Kiana got to do the TLC like backup vocals for that. And then we got to do a dance with him on stage.
I saw that. And like, you were actually on stage performing with him. Cause like,
yeah,
so
awesome.
All that, remember, it was kind of like, for my listeners, it was like Saturday Night Live. Like, they would have guest appearances and like they would have typically a musical performance.
Yeah.
So like for the 10-year anniversary reunion special, they had Bow Wow. He wasn't Lil, he was just Bow Wow now. And he performed the All That theme song. And Lisa, like the three of them, were actually backup singers. Like, they're on stage with him as his backup dancers. Like, you literally performed with Bow Wow. What was that like?
It was so much fun because I was a dancer my whole life. I still do some dancing now, but I was a competitive ballet, jazz, and mostly tap dancer for most of my life. Like I just went around the country just winning competitions for most of my childhood. So anytime that all that let me dance like on the show, I was always so thrilled. So yeah, getting to do that with Bow Wow was it was a dream come true. It was awesome.
Oh my God, that's so fucking cool. That is so cool. So I have a question or two in one.
No, you're good.
So you live in Las Vegas now. So have you always lived here? And like, how did you get in the business? Especially since it was the 2000s. Did you like send emails back then? Or did you guys have to like look up agencies in the phone book? Or did you happen to know somebody or have a connection in the industry already? Sorry, that was like three, four questions in one.
I really was kind of like a just one of those unbelievable Hollywood stories where like I didn't know anybody. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I was born in Portland, Oregon. I'm a Portland girl, and lived in Spokane, Washington for a long time. And that's why I did a lot of my competition dancing. And I just had some of these incredible, not to toot my own horn, but looking back at my younger self, I was like really proud of myself. Like some of these dances that I was doing as a kid, as I think I won my first trophy at like age 4 for like a solo, like on stage. But some of the acts I was doing were like incredible. I had this song and dance where I would tap and sing at the same time, not like tap and then take a break and sing. I was tapping and singing at the same time. And that like cleaned up. I would always like win competitions with that. And eventually I was proud of myself, like not to be cocky, but I'm like, I can't believe I did that. I couldn't do that now. It's hard. But yeah, so eventually some judges just, and I was doing some theater, right? I was doing like just local community theater just to kind of get the feeling for acting while I was dancing and taking singing lessons. And eventually some judges from one of the competitions pulled my mom aside and they were like, hey, like she's talented and she's not going to have a career in Spokane, Washington. So get her out of here. Take her to LA. So bless my parents, they did. They picked up and they moved to Riverside, California, so we didn't have to live right in LA. And didn't know anybody. I mean, my mom literally bought a book that was just like acting in Hollywood, like how to do it. And eventually just talked to a very, very, very small agent, auditioned for them, and they took me on. I did a couple commercials, and then eventually Even Stevens was my first TV job. And loved that, but I was always a Nickelodeon girl, like growing up.
Wait, Even Stevens was your first TV job?
Yeah, Even Stevens is my
That
first
was
job.
your first job.
I did a pilot before that, but the pilot never aired, so I don't really count that.
That's amazing.
But yeah, so Even Stevens is my first one, and it was a blast. I loved it. And my character was Christie's mega fan, right? Like it was me and this other little girl. We were Carla and Marla, and we were like the biggest fan of Ren. And we looked up to her for everything she did. So then the one episode where she gets an F, or I think she gets an F in woodshop class or something, we're just like, we're like so let down, right? We're like, she's not as perfect as we thought she was. And we're just like totally let down. And then, moral of the story is you don't have to be perfect in everything you do. And so yeah, Shia was always there. He's a crazy hyperactive kid. Just he was like always on a skateboard. He was just like come in like a tornado and then leave. Funny as hell. All of them. I mean, Chrissy is so sweet. Worked with Lauren Frost as Ruby. I still talk to Lauren every once in a while, and yeah, it was great. But growing up watching TV, I was a Nickelodeon kid. Like I watched Nickelodeon. I didn't watch Disney as much. I was a Nickelodeon girl. I feel like those are the cool kids, right? Like the real ones watch Nickelodeon, like Salute Your Shorts and Pete and Pete and Ren and Stimpy, like all the old Nickelodeon shows. So when the auditions for all that came along, I was so stoked. It was a nationwide search for a brand new cast. It was like a six callback process, and got to the very end. They had narrowed it down. I mean, thousands of kids. They narrowed it down to 12. And then after we did our final auditions, they came out and they're like, "All right, we're gonna narrow it down to seven of you. You've all done great. Thank you so much. We'll let you know by this day." And that day came and went, and I never heard anything, and I was starting to get devastated. But then it was like 2 weeks after that, I was in the middle of tennis lessons. I was taking tennis lessons. My dad was a huge like tennis star, and so I always kind of wanted to learn how to play. So I was on the tennis court, and my mom like sprints down, like, "You got it!" I'm like, "What?" Like, "You got all that!" I was like, "Ah!" Like, I just booked my favorite show of all time. Is my favorite show.
That's so cool.
And yeah, it was absolutely dream come true. It was so cool. It was amazing. Really, seriously, like. I always make the joke that like if it was still on and they'd still let me be on it, I'd still be doing
Oh, yeah.
it. It was a dream.
Oh, that's so cool that you enjoyed it so much. So you joined all that in season 7, and this was during a revival period. So seasons 1 through 6 was all one cast, and they were all switched out by a new cast in season 7, which was the cast you worked on. So you guys replace the original All That cast, which was like Kenan and Kel and Josh Server and Amanda Bynes and Lori Beth Denberg and Danny Tamborelli. So
Yeah.
what was all that like? Like, did that feel like a lot of pressure to be the new All That cast at that time?
Yeah, I didn't really think too much about like the pressures. I mean, I was 14 when I booked the show. So I was aware that we had big shoes to fill, and we talked about it all the time because me and the other cast members, we were all so like-minded. We were all huge fans of the original show. Like, I worshipped Amanda Bynes. Like, she was my idol. I loved her. And we were aware that like this is going to be a tough one to like to s fill these shoes and convince the audience that like we can do it too. But also 6 years is a long time, and kids grow up a lot when from year to year when they're young. I mean, like you have kids, like you have a kid, between age 6 and 7 and 8, radically different people. Like Chloe was a totally different girl when she was 6 than she is now, and she's 7. It was like different person.
For sure.
So the kids who were watching Kenan and Kel and Lori Beth and Elisa Reyes and Katrina Johnson in the first seasons of All That, they were too old to watch us. They're not sticking around and still watching season 7. So we thankfully had our own brand new audience. We had our own fans who talk to me all the time who are like, "I never actually watched the original All That." They'll be like, "I never watched Kimi Kao. I was too small. I was too young." Again, that's like 7 years. So like we started watching with your seasons. So, yeah, we endure the jokes throughout the years, like the new, "Oh, you're the new Saved by the Bell," like the college years, the jokes about like, "Oh, you'll never be as good as the original cast." Of course, I'm gonna hear that for the rest of my life. It's popular to say that. It's an easy TikTok joke. Yeah, it's easy, but the truth is that people don't get it, that we had our own fans, and our show was successful. Obviously, they kept renewing it, and it we idolized the original cast just as much as the fans did. So like when Keenan came on, we were all starstruck. It was none of this like, "We're just as good as the original cast and we're gonna do better." We were like, "Oh my gosh, we get to stand on the same set as Kel Mitchell, like, oh
For
my gosh."
sure.
So yeah.
So I made a list of all these cool stars that you met on your first season. So like your first year working on this show, these were some of the people that you met and you worked with on stage. Episode 1 had Aaron Carter and Frankie Muniz. Episode 2 had Melissa Joan Hart and Usher. And then goes P. Diddy, Britney Spears, Tony Hawk, Bare Naked Ladies, David Arquette, Mandy Moore, and so on. There's Christina Milian, Lisa Leslie, Willa Ford, Will Friedle.
Oh yeah, and I have stories for each one of them. Like, it's just crazy. Like, I have such vivid memories from those years, because I was having such a good time, and I was so cognizant of the fact that it wasn't normal, and I was cognizant of the fact that it was a job, that it wasn't just playtime, and that it could end at any minute. That's Hollywood. This is a job. We are employed. It could end, and my parents kept me humble on all fronts, like just all the time. And I didn't go to a lot of the big, Hollywood parties and the publicity stuff. And again, like smartphones didn't exist, so I wasn't trying to, it always kind of breaks my heart seeing the kids on like iCarly and Victorious, those like later years when there are smartphones. And I'm like, I can't imagine. I'm sure they were all competing for Instagram followers and like, "Oh, tag me," and like, "Oh, let's do this." Like, I didn't have to deal with that. Like, I just got to live in the moment every single day with my best friends. Like, my cast, they were my best friends. Every day, I would get on set early and I would leave late, and I would hang out with the crew, and I would go to props, and I'd look at the prop, and I'd go to hair and makeup. Like, I just loved everybody. And I was just having the time of my life. Like every day I was there, I just couldn't get enough of it. I forget where I was going with that. Oh yeah, but that's but yeah, the whole, smartphone thing, like I'm so glad that I got to experience those years without having to compete for followers with my fellow cast members. It sounds like a nightmare.
So do you keep in touch with any of your old castmates? Like
Yeah,
I've
go for
seen on Instagram that you still talk to Giovanni Samuels, right?
Yes. She was one of my very, very best friends. And we went through everything together. And I'm aware of the new documentary that just came out. I haven't watched it yet. I've like seen pieces here and there, and I'm interested to see, what everybody says and where that goes. At the end of the day, I'll just say what I've always said. And I've said this in a million interviews. I've said it on my podcast. I can only speak to my own experience. And you talk to me, you're gonna get a lot of positivity. Like you're gonna get super fun stories. Like I was a naive kid. I was very young. I was very innocent. I was the girl on set who, like, if Kyle would swear, I'd like slap him on the shoulder and be like, "Don't swear. Like, be good." They would always compare me and Kyle to like Dee Dee and Dexter from Dexter's Laboratory. Like I was like the happy ballerina, and he was like the like grumpy little kid who was like a 40-year-old guy in like a 12-year-old body. I was such good friends with all of them. And I still talk to Gio every once in a while on the phone, and we talk on Instagram. I talk to Chelsea very rarely, which is sad. I wish I could talk to her more. And Jack, I just saw Jack recently. He came out to Vegas. Brian, I talked to Brian once in a while. Leon, I ran into Leon at Disneyland a couple months ago. It was so good to see him. And Elisa and I had a project we were working on for a couple months, which was, oh, it was such a good project. I'm so sad it never like when I it never went anywhere. Katrina Johnson took me out for one of my birthdays here in Vegas. She used to live here, and she still visits from time to time. And she was here for my birthday. And I was having a terrible birthday. Like I was just having the worst birthday. And she's like, "Girl, I'm gonna fix it." And she did. She like took me to like a chandelier bar, and like we did shots and drinks. And she like turned it into like the best birthday ever. Like you want to have fun, you go hang out with Katrina. Like she's the best. Danny Tamberelli, still talk to him every once in a while. Josh Server, it's they're all great.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I have to ask this.
No, go for it.
But do you remember meeting Will Friedle?
Oh yeah.
Ugh, I love Boy Meets World. I love Will Friedle.
No, I was a huge fan of his growing up because I love Boy Meets World. And then he was a guest star on our show. And then years later, kind of reconnected with him again, and I got to go to to a screening of he did a voice in Thundercats, and they like revamped Thundercats. And I went over to his house with a bunch of people and like watched that. He's the sweetest guy. Super, super nice.
I love Will Friedle. I listen to Pod Meets World a lot, which is the Pod Meets World, or it's the recap podcast for Boy Meets World, and it stars Will Friedle, Danielle Fischel, and Ryder Strong, which is Topanga, Sean, and Eric. Not in that order. And I agree with you about how like times before iPhones were a great time, but I really love that child stars now have this platform to talk about their experiences, whether positive or negative. Like I really like to listen to, aside from Pod Meets World, Christy Carlson Romano from Even Stevens and Allison Stoner, and also the kids from Ned's Declassified School Survival Guide.
Oh, they're great.
And for the record, I think it's great to acknowledge that some people have wonderful experiences. I think society has a tendency to like victim blame celebrities and act like you guys are just asking for it or willingly submitting to abuse for fame and money. But the reality is like most of you are doing it because you love what you do. It isn't it kind of unfair to blame you and tell you that you asked for it? Like, of course we know it's not always safe or fair, but I can't imagine that everyone is just tolerating this unbearable suffering.
Absolutely. And you know what? Look, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. It was a job. Like I said, this was not playtime. We were being paid to do a job. So yes, there was pressure, and there were some days that were very long and very hard, and we got very tired. But we got paid for it. Again, this is a job. And yeah, you know, we had the on-air dares, like that was like these crazy like Fear Factor stuff where we had to do like really gross stuff. But every single step of the way, they would check in with us. They would make sure we were good. They would yell hold if anything went weird. Like I felt safe 100% of the time on set. Like I just, you know, we get slimed. It's Nickelodeon. It's gross. You're getting slimed. You're getting pied in the face. I had to swim in chili. I got covered in dead fish, you know, like I had frogs jumping all over me. I always say that like I'm fearless now that I was on Nickelodeon because there was no time to be apprehensive. You could be, and they would be very patient, you know, like the first time I had to deal with a tarantula, I was a little scared of that. But then by like season four, I played a goth character named Claudia. And in one of the scenes, I was just supposed to have tarantulas just crawling all over me. And by season four, I was like, just bring them in, just bring them in, just put them on. Okay, and roll. Like it didn't even faze me. There was a scene where I had to put a live cockroach in my mouth.
Oh my God.
And it's one of my favorite stories because, you know, I love seeing on a call sheet that there's a cockroach wrangler. Because that's what they say. There's like a dog, there's a dog wrangler, a chicken wrangler. So the cockroach wrangler comes up to me and he's like, okay, so here's what you need to know about this hissing cockroach, right? So you're going to want to put it in your mouth. You kind of just gently squeeze in between your tongue and the roof of your mouth to make sure he doesn't try to crawl down your throat. That's step one. Step two, he's gonna spit into your mouth because that's his, when he's scared, they spit.
Oh, no, 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 no,
So
no, no, no,
just
no.
don't worry about that. It's non-toxic.
What the fuck?
I forget what the other one was. I don't know if there was another one. Maybe I feel like there was three things he said. Is like don't gently squeeze him. Oh, and his little feet are gonna like lock onto your tongue because yeah, like little grabbers. And I was like, bring it on. Let's again, this is season four. So like at that time, at this time, I'm like fearless. Like I'm like just whatever it is, just bring it on. Like I got this. I'll live through it. And so I did it. You know, I took the little guy, like wriggling. I don't. And cut. And it's okay, done. Like I
Jeez.
did it. And then we replaced it with a fake one, and then I ate the fake one. You know, Jack had a scorpion in his mouth for one of the on-air dares, and I remember like it was so gnarly looking. They taped the scorpion's claws shut so that he couldn't like pinch him, and they he held like the stinger on his tail like far enough away from his face. And I remember like when they yelled action and he had to do it. I remember, I mean, he was like wincing and like the whole thing, and I was just like, oh my gosh, is Jack okay? Like, and then they hit cut. They said cut, and I'm like, Jack, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, I was just acting. I was like, wait, really? He's like, yeah, I was just pretending that it was gross because that's what we do. And he just laughed and like went on. I was like, oh my God. And I was like, that's such a funny. They're just funny things that like I always felt proud of myself that like I did it. You know, it's just a silly thing. Oh yeah, and I'm sure, you know, again, I can only speak to my own experience, and I'm sure if I had all my other cast members here and we talked about the on-air dares, I'm sure a couple of them would be like, "Yeah, but what about that one? I was not okay with that one." And we could hash it out here, but I remember just the whole process, the staff being like the crew being like hyper aware that this is weird, gross stuff that we're doing, and they're like, "We got to make sure this is like safe and everybody's good the whole time." But I never felt like I was like any gross stuff that we were doing. I never felt like it was like dangerous or anything. It's just it's Nickelodeon.
So now you're in a metal band.
Yes.
It's actually like a Halloween metal band, right?
Yeah.
And I've heard you say that your character Claudia from All That had something to do with it.
Yes. Well, like I said, I was this happy-go-lucky, innocent ray of sunshine child. Like, I mean, I wore bright colors. I shopped at Limited Too. I watched Powerpuff Girls. Like, I just was happy all the time. And so I think it was almost like a little joke for the writers to be like, let's make her a goth. Let's make her the complete opposite of her personality. And I loved it because, you know, I was also an actor. So I'm like, I can do this. I can embody this like goth character. And I remember the first fitting, like costume fitting, where, you know, they put all the fishnets on me and the black wig and the nose ring and all the rings and the cuffs. And these are actually Claudia cuffs. These came from Claudia. But, you know, all the jewelry. And I just remember looking in the mirror, just like, I look awesome. Like, this is Really cool. And yeah, like I said, it did. It just awoke something in me. And I loved playing that character, and so many people loved that character. In fact, I've gotten so many messages through the years from girls now who are like, "Hey, looking back, like you were the first like alt girl on TV that I watched, and you made me feel like it was okay to dress the way that I dress, and like thanks for like representing alt girls." And I'm like, "You like thank you." Like
This was Claudia from the sleepover scene you had with Giovanni and Chelsea.
yes, we all got together. We had the boy crazy Chelsea. We had the innocent one, Giovanni, which is funny because that's like my personality. Like I should have been the innocent one. And then Claudia, the goth one, but no matter what, we were all BFFs. Like we could be different walks of life, different walks of life, different interests, but we were still best friends at the end of every day. But yeah, at the end of every season, I got to keep a big chunk of the wardrobe because it wasn't going to fit us again next year, and they're not going to keep it all. So they gave me a lot of Claudia clothes, and just having it in my wardrobe, I was like,
That's so cool.
I'm gonna start wearing some of this just normally. And then I started listening to different music, and suddenly I'm wearing doing darker makeup, and like I'm changing a little bit. Like I'm learning about this new side of me that I didn't have before. And yeah, I kind of became like a little goth kid like
I love
for a
that.
while. And yeah, now I'm in the horror heavy metal rock and roll band Von Volt, and I love it. I love it so much. I could be on stage with that band every night for the rest of my life.
So Lisa is the backup vocalist for Von Bolt. Go check it out. It's like metal, but it's like Halloween metal, right?
Yeah, it's like Halloween horror metal, like kind of Misfits, vibe. And yeah, please look us up on Spotify and follow us on Instagram at Von Volt Band and support us. Every local band needs support, as So yeah.
Yeah, so go listen to it. It's called Von Bolt. Look up Lisa Foyles on Instagram. Oh, and listen to her podcast. It's called Temperamental.
Yes, Temperamental with Lisa Foyles. It's me and my cat. I have a cat co-host.
And real quick, before we wrap this up, I have a quote that I heard on your podcast that I really want to read.
Oh boy.
Okay,
What is it?
it's my three favorite crimes would have to be indecent exposure, unsportsmanlike conduct, and tomfoolery. I think you can get charged with tomfoolery. Nonsense? Mayhem!
It's you can get charged with mayhem, silliness. It's like you got in trouble for silliness. No, it's funny. I was saying that, I do remember that quote. I was saying that in reference to my only run-in with the police my whole life. Actually, two run-ins with the police. One was for drinking on the streets in Idaho, but I was very emotional and there was nobody there and I was just on an empty street. And my only other run-in with the cops was a jaywalking ticket. That's right. Your girl's a rebel. Your girl sometimes crosses the street when she's not supposed to. Although I don't so much anymore because that ticket scared me. It was expensive. It was a $250 ticket or something like that. Crazy.
Almost like Woodstock 99. Okay, that's all for today. Thank you so much to Lisa Foyles for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a
Oh my
blast.
God, thank
You're
you.
so wonderful and I love your podcast and
Me?
you're so great and so
You're so
talented. I
great.
know this is so
No,
much
you are.
fun. You are. I will fight you. Oh my
My
God.
God. This is so much fun. I just want to say, if I could say one more thing to you before you go, Lisa. I feel like we all kind of grow up watching certain people on TV, and like sometimes we put them on a pedestal. And that's one of the things that we talk about on this podcast a lot is how like you create this image of a character or an artist on TV, and then you're completely let down when they don't turn out to be everything you hope for. And I think you are just exactly what we all hoped you would become. Like you grew up exactly how you
Oh.
turned out to be exactly how we all hoped. Like, not only are you so nice, but you're still so fucking funny and so, like, boldly and unapologetically you. And I'm just so glad that you never lost that sparkle.
You're so sweet. Oh my gosh, you just like brightened my whole day.
I love you.
I love you too. I'm gonna go out and conquer the world now. You filled me with all this confidence.
Okay.
Oh, you're the best. This is so much fun.
All right, guys, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget that you can always go to brokenlimelight.com to get a recap of this episode. There's a whole, like, this one will be pretty close to a transcript. And I'm going to have some clips of like Lisa Foyles as well as about Woodstock 99. So please go check it out. Don't forget to follow Broken Limelight on Instagram and Facebook. And yeah, brokenlimelight.com. Thank you guys so much. Bye.